We considered last time the process of purification of the lower inner instrument, the lower antahkarana as we called it, and today we are to study the purification of the intelligence and the buddhi. We have already seen the distinction between mind and buddhi. Mind, we have discussed in depth, consists of the sense mind, the mind that depends upon the data brought by the senses, mentalizes the data and reacts from the nervous level, that is the sensational mind. Depending upon it, close to it, is the thinking mind, not the thought mind proper, but the mind that thinks along the lines of the sense mind. Above that is the reasoning mind, which if it chooses, it can be aloof, it can be detached from the sense operations of the mind, or it can allow itself to be infected, influenced, and led into deviation by the force of desire. Buddhi is something still higher. It is a combination of will and the thinking mind. The will that gives the impulse to the thinking mind, and the thinking mind begins to function. So it is these, the higher echelons of the mind and the buddhi, that are now to be purified after the lower levels of the antahkarana, the inner instrumentation, have been tackled. What is called in Sanskrit or Indian terminology, manas, the sense mind, usually the mind in an average man is the manas, sense mind. He does not think for sake of thinking. He does not think out ideas. He just reacts to events, to impacts, to contacts. Things fall upon him and he reacts. The whole operation of his mind is 90% confined to that. As somebody said, nature thinks, man does not think. He is thought. But at a level where you still have a certain independence and you can think out ideas, give exercise to your mind and judge things on your own without depending upon sense contact, that is the beginning of the mind proper. In the normal manas, there are two elements. One is the physical nervous. You see an object, or you think there is an object, there is an impulse from the nervous being, and the sense faculties shoot out. When they come back, there is a mental nervous operation. What has been brought, the report that has been brought, is interpreted rightly or wrongly to suit the governing motive, desire of the moment, and a mental coloring is given to that. These are the two elements of manas. Now, for sake of purification, man has first to disengage his thought from this sense mentality. One must be conscious indeed that there is a layer of the mind which reacts naturally, spontaneously to sense contacts. But before we absorb those experiences and allow them to influence or cloud our thinking, we have to draw the line. A gulf has to be created, a barrier has to be erected before the sense impressions, the movements of the sense mind can rush into the mind proper. The thought has to be guarded. For that, a self-observation, a relentless discipline of observing one's thoughts, how far they are disinterested, how far they seek knowledge for its own sake, and how far they want to see things and interpret things to fulfill our desires, how far they can to interpret in a way that they can be made to serve our ego, our desire, that it is not a pure action. This impurity, what Sri Aurobindo calls this emissions of the lower elements in the thought range, that has to be first arrested. And the first step towards it in an awakened man, in a man who has awakened to the necessity of going beyond the sense mind, is reflection. He has to reflect time and again, not necessarily only in periods of meditation or solitude, but even otherwise. One faculty must be always active, reflecting upon things, just as we may be busy with so many things, but feelings go on. Feelings go on flowing, feelings go on exerting themselves. Similarly, there must be a automatic functioning of the reflective apparatus in us, especially those who seek the truth. To study the nature of the movements that go on, as soon as a thought rises in our mental horizon, there must be an instant reflection. What is it? From where does it come? And why does it come? Is it something in me which I may have thought yesterday, or a thought that crossed me, or something in dream that has given rise to this thought? Or is it somebody in my environment that may be thinking on those lines, and that thought has entered into my mind? Or is it due to some desire, some impurity that has come? All these we don't think step by step, if you know what I mean. It is a operation of a moment. There is something that nature has implanted in us. Unless we choose to deceive ourselves, unless we try to hide from ourselves, in a second there is a perception that this thought is related to this desire or this movement. Of course, there are times when things are ambiguous and one has to give closer scrutiny to find out what is the true nature. That is another matter. But normally, when we speak of reflection in this context, it is a spontaneous and automatic reflection which acts unless we are too much involved in the mud of desire. The buddhi part, the part that has will in it and decides, this shall be so, this shall not be so, that is a little separate. The reflective element is not to be confused with the buddhi. Reflective is at the thought level. the higher or the purer or the disinterested thought, in that range the reflection starts. It is just possible that even when you know by reflection that a thing is wrong, you may lack the will to follow it up. There comes the deficiency of will in the buddhi. It is not enough to have knowledge, not enough to know that a thing is wrong, but you must also have the will in the buddhi to back up this conviction and exert itself on the rest of the being to desist from that movement. So the buddhi, which is largely the will part of intelligence, it comes after reflection. And ultimately, what is this buddhi? Is it an independent organ? It is truly an instrument of the soul. The soul has so many instruments, but buddhi is one of its closest instruments. Through it, the soul awakes to nature. Unless our buddhi is alert, the awakening of the soul cannot be felt in our nature. It is through the buddhi that the soul reaches its awareness, awakening its own will upon our being, upon our nature. The understanding of the buddhi also is caused by a wave from the soul. When it is a right understanding, it is the soul within that is responsible. And it is again through the instrumentation of buddhi that the soul takes possession of nature. Instead of the soul being involved in nature, as the soul awakes, it is through the instrumentality of the buddhi, awakened intelligence, that the soul exercises its power over nature. And the aim is gradually to build up through the buddhi a full possession of nature and a complete mastery over nature. Soul and nature have got different poises at different levels of evolution. At the normal level of human life, it is nature that which has the upper hand. Soul is involved, soul is forgotten, soul is a slave. As we wake up, as our consciousness develops, as we take appropriate means of self-discipline, the soul separates itself and witnesses nature. There is the relation of equality. The soul does not interfere, but it goes on organizing its detached position, non-involvement. Once it is sufficiently free, liberated from the hold of nature, even as a witness, sakshi, then the soul takes a step higher and begins to assume overlordship over nature. The soul becomes the master of nature. And through all these, for all these steps to be taken, it is buddhi that is the instrument. It is through the exercise of buddhi that the soul gains ascendancy over nature, takes the enjoyment of nature, the intended enjoyment for the divine. In spiritual life, what happens mostly is the rejection of nature. They all speak of rejection of nature. You cannot change nature. The classic example is given of the dog's tail. Twist however much you will, it will go back to its curve. But that is a negative philosophy. It is not true either. But it suits the escapists. It suits people whose objective is only to escape from life, to cancel themselves from the scheme of evolution and seek to merge into some nirvana, either of a zero or of Brahma, to speak of rejection of nature. It is enough for them that nature is put away, the soul is separated, and for that, and in that scheme, no action is permitted as part of spiritual life. Action has to be gone through to exhaust the accumulated karma, perhaps. But action is a binding force. Whatever action you do, with whatever motive or no motive, it binds, it forges karma, which can be exhausted only with the falling of the body. So, neither change of nature nor action from a new poise of nature are envisaged, much less practiced, in many of the lines of spiritual effort. But in an integral path like this, which seeks to perfect life, which knows that in a sense there is no difference or distinction between nature and soul, that nature after all is a self-casting of the soul, a movement of the soul. This standpoint is not valid. We have to accept nature, change nature little by little, and make it a willing instrument and a joyous channel for the flow of the dynamisms of the soul. And for that purpose, buddhi is the highest instrument that nature has given us. How are we going to purify this buddhi, this intelligence that is backed up by will? First is, exceed the limits of the sense mind. Normally we are content. When things come in our ken, we see them. The senses see, the eye hears, and finish. But it is possible to take cognizance of things even without the operation of the sense faculty. Of all our sense faculties, it is touch that is the most important. But below the human level, the trees, for instance, the animals, even without the sense of touch, they come to know, because there is their sense mind, the sense mentality, takes a direct cognizance of things without bothering to function through these particular sense organs. Man has lost that capacity. He will recover it perhaps in a large different terms, but he has to cultivate, to exceed the habit and discipline of exceeding the limits of the sense mind. For instance, he can learn to exercise his thought faculty on its own without being propped up by the sense data. He can learn to think and govern his life, develop the ethical part of his mind on its own, without depending upon the compulsions of sense life to teach him lessons. Similarly, the aesthetic part, the aesthetic faculties of his mind, he can develop in their purity without being entangled in what the senses find appealing or repelling. These are all starting points, but we shall not take the sense data as the entire field and the sole cause and impulsion for the development of our mind. There is such a thing as thought mind proper, ethical mind proper, aesthetic mind proper. These are to be developed for their own sake, to build up a total perfection. We should not have to depend upon prodding of sense experience to build up this personality. Similarly, we have what is called the pragmatic mind. Everything we consider from the point of view, we are likely to consider, we are prone to consider from the point of view of how far things are useful to us. In American philosophy, there is one whole branch initiated by William James called philosophy of pragmatism. He says that anything, any theory, any conception, any perception is true or not true depending solely upon how far it is serviceable to life. If it can better your life, if it can enlighten your life, personal life, then it is true, good. You accept it, you give a positive mark. Otherwise, you reject it as speculative, as mental, as imaginary. So this tendency of relating everything to its pragmatic value to you is a very narrow view of things in this context. There is this pragmatic mind, which is again ties the mind down to earth, earthly needs, earthly benefits. This has to be replaced by what we call the ideal mind. There, we think of things on their own basis. A thought comes, a conception, an idea forms. Well, we consider it, how far it is true and why it is not true in some places. But we do not relate it, whether it will be useful for this purpose or that purpose. Things do not always have a utilitarian aim. After all the higher things of our civilization have been evolved not from the utilitarian standpoint. Though today in our materialist civilization, we seek to judge from that barometer. But in days when those ancients or the higher, our ancestors or people of civilizations higher than ours, they thought and they moved in different realms, truth for its own sake. Of course, there is a controversy whether you can have art for its own sake and truth for its own sake, but these are all mental debates. But the point is, it is a necessary part of purification to disengage ourselves from the pragmatic element in our mentality. We should cultivate an ideal mind. And even when we cultivate the ideal mind, it is seen that in a hundred-veiled form, there is the emissions, unknown mixture of shootings from desire, from selfish motive. Already there is some prejudgment. Desire need not be always a physical and a crude desire for food and drink. Desire can be to entertain my pet notions, to infect others with them, to get others to accept my philosophy of life. There is already a proclivity, a proneness to have certain ideas, to have certain truths. And when I speak of ideal mind, these subconscious tendencies, preferences, likes, they creep in. And it is a part of purification to close the doors to this upsurge, known and unknown, seen and unseen, of these elements from the unpurified parts of the being. And as this purification on these various levels of forming mind, the aesthetic mind, the ethical mind, thinking mind, the ideal mind, as we go on, whenever we have opportunity, whenever there is an occasion, to build up these terraces of consciousness, as we would call, there is a greater and greater detachment from involvement in the lower movements of the inner instrumentation. There is an increasing discovery of something that exists by itself. It does not care whether it serves your life needs or not. It has been there before you have been born, and it will be there after you shed the body. This self-existent being, you become aware in a very profound and solemn manner. And this being which is there casts its reflection in your aesthetic consciousness, aesthetic level of your consciousness, ethical level of your consciousness, knowledge level and will level. That is where things are in their purity. All the rest you can contribute, your technique, your methods of presentation. But the basically, things, they are reflections of a self-existent being. The being has intended them as so many springboards for manifestation into those relevant areas of human existence. Again we come back to the necessity to give free room and free scope for this emergence of the self-existent being into the consciousness. We have first to remove desire of all kinds from the buddhi. The buddhi has to be lifted up from its involvement in our sense mind or reasoning mind or whatever kind of mind you say. As long as these minds are open to the winds of impurity, and as you begin to eliminate desire consciously, you begin to feel a certain effortless detachment. With detachment, there comes an equality. Your buddhi is not tossed about, as Arjuna says in the Gita, with the sense contact. Whether the contacts are pleasant or unpleasant in the normal sense of the long term, the buddhi is equal. There is a certain equanimity. It observes, it watches. And with this equality, there establishes a calm which nothing can disturb. even if there is an apparent disturbance, it is on the surface, very much like you throw a stone in a pond of water, there is a movement, but it settles down, and once again there is the limpid surface of water. I think we should stop here. There is still a lot. We'll take it up next time. I don't want to hurry up, because these are all important things. Any question?
You said about the soul's awakening, but what are the signs of soul's awakening? How can we feel that soul is awakening?
The soul has got certain characteristic qualities. And these qualities express themselves through their powers. The soul, for instance, has the quality of harmony, love, compassion, benevolence, beauty, wholeness. Love, disinterested love, disinterested goodwill, and a welling up of kindliness, compassion, constant, a going out of yourself to identify yourself with others, feel for others. When you look round, you will feel a certain unity with nature. You begin to feel love for everybody, whether it is a dog or an animal or a parrot or a person or a bugger. The whole thing is flooded, and you feel all the troubles, all the cares, all the anxieties of day-to-day life as a pittance. They don't affect you. You are always smiling. May not outwardly, you may not smile, but there is a smile within you. There is a revolution in the whole balance of nature. It may not be immediate, but these signs are unmistakable. What may happen is, in the beginning, this awakening does not come all at a time. In parts. But what happens, unless we have taken steps to purify ourselves, is the emotional being seizes upon these manifestations of the soul and push them to its own use. The vital will cease, unless it is purified and kept in check. It will cease upon these movements of expansion, these movements of self-sacrifice, of giving up oneself, all these for its own aggrandizement, to gain command over people, to gain control over people, to assemble people around itself. All these, the original source of support and strength is the soul, a soul movement, but it has been seized and prostituted by the unpurified outer instrument, whether it is the emotional parts or the vital parts or the calculating mind. So these parts, in an atmosphere like this, like the ashram, everyone, without exception, has his moments when the soul is awake. He has moments. He may begin to doubt next moment, and the smoke may cover it up. But still, the atmosphere constantly presses upon it and the soul awakes. These are the characteristic signs. The flow of love, feeling of oneness and unity, and identification with larger and larger sections of your environment, and a wide sense of purity. You can't think ill of others. If a thought harmful to others or ill, making slight of others comes into your mind, you feel unclean. You feel as if you have dirtied yourself. When that sensitivity is reached to the surface, you can take it that the soul is awake, and whatever the stupidities of the ignorant being outside, the soul will not be denied. Once the soul is awake, it cannot be put back to sleep. You can obstruct its light coming out, you can put shadows and smokes, but it is bound to bore through. And if the outer crust is made too hard, then the soul leaves the body. Chitta is the basic stuff of consciousness, whole being. It is neutral. It is neutral. There is an area where there is no force as such, active force. There is an area where there is no awakened thought. The chitta is the basic stuff out of which, whether it is the mind, the heart, all subliminal, all these draw upon that. Chitta is not mental consciousness. Chitta, as Srivarinda translates it, is the basic stuff of our consciousness. No. Will is there. Inalienable from the soul. The Purusha, the soul is the Purusha. Where there is Purusha, there is the soul, there is the will, there is the Buddhi. It is only we who have to learn to evoke that Buddhi, to activize it, to give it exercise, to give it shape, to give it personality. We have to develop it as we develop the physical muscle. In small matters also we have to start exercising our will as a discipline. After a time, without your effort, the will exerts itself spontaneously. There is what is called a subconscious will, an instinctive will. Once you develop the will consciously, that control goes down to the subconscious. And even when you are attentive elsewhere, the subconscious or this unconscious will exerts itself. It is a matter of practice. When?
With the vital is often associated more than with the mind.
Usually, the vital puts the will on its side. Will is neutral. Will is neutral. If at that time when the vital draws the will on its side, if the mind also puts the will on its side, the mental will prevail, because the mind is in a higher position. But at that time when the vital allies itself with the will, we like it. Our being, our desire soul supports it. That is why it can get away. If the desire soul is replaced or displaced by the true soul, the problem does not arise.